Boy, you guys want to jump right into a bag of worms.
In a world where only the strong survive, there comes a time when the only way to settle the score is a one-on-one battle to the finish. Two entrepreneurs enter, but only one of them leaves. It's the Entrepreneur Showdown with Joe Cassandra and Dan Franks. Now, on to the showdown.
I am Dan Franks, that is Joe Cassandra, and this is the Entrepreneur Showdown. Now, before we get on to the showdown, I wanted to take a moment to thank each and every one of you who've left us a review on iTunes. We've had a great showing of support so far, and we look forward to much more. If you haven't checked it out yet, head on over to iTunes, check out the Entrepreneur Showdown there, leave us a review, click the subscribe button, and don't miss another episode. Now, today on the showdown, in round one, Joe and I look at the issue of procrastination, extending deadlines, what troubles it can cause you in your entrepreneurial journeys, and maybe a few tips on how to avoid it. Then in round two, Joe and I talk about family matters, and more importantly, how some very specific family issues might affect you and your entrepreneurial journeys, so don't want to miss that. And we talk to somebody in the main event who is very familiar with family issues as it relates to small business ownership and entrepreneurship, and that is Dan Miller from 48 Days. Huge guest today, huge show on tap, so you want to stick around for that. But before we move on, don't forget to head on over to www.entrepreneurshowdown.com for the show notes of this episode and a whole lot more. And now, let's get on to the showdown.
Round one.
Right now, what Joe and I want to talk about is something that plagues everybody, every entrepreneur, every large business, and even the nation itself, and that's extending deadlines. And something that brought this issue to light was recently in June of 2013 when the United States government extended this Affordable Health Care Act deadline. It was supposed to be starting in January of 2014, and about June of 2013, about 6 or 7 months prior, they decided to extend that deadline a year. And what this brings to light is, you know, extending deadlines, what does it do? Does it really help people, or does it just create more problems? And there's a few specific things an article that Joe and I found discuss with extending deadlines and why they're probably not good. And the first one is we lose motivation. You know, when you see something coming down, you're getting close to the finish line, you're motivated to get things done. But when all of a sudden that finish line goes way far in the future again, then you kind of pull back as well. So in reality, you think you're giving yourself more time to work on something, but that's not really what's happening. You're really just going to more than likely delay the inevitable even more.
But it also can add, if say you didn't have everything in place that you wanted to, if you have that extended deadline where you have more time to finish up a product or finish up whatever, a paper, as since we were both came from college, I think that when I have that extended deadline, that I have more time to, I guess, be creative. Because here's the thing. Most people, they wait till the last second to complete whatever. That's just what humans do. But since you've already started the process and you get that extended amount of time, you're going to keep going at whatever you were working on, a paper, product, or whatever. And so you're going to have that extended time to make it better, have more time to market it or prepare to market it. So it'd actually be more motivating to actually have started the project and then you have that extended time to continue working on it further.
Joe, I think you're living in a fantasy world here. I think if that's how you operate, then, you know, God save the rest of us, because we're bowing down to you.
That's how it. Okay, if you start something and you know you're going to have to finish it at some point, it's not one of those open-ended things that, I want to start a blog, but there's no one holding me accountable. That's not the same deadline as if, hey, you need to have this paper in due by then. So if you've already started something and you're already in that groove, then you already have the motivation to finish it, and now that you have that extended time, you can expand on any thoughts you had or any of those things that were nagging you. Like, I never got to fully complete that part that I wanted to. You now have the time to do that.
I think human nature says if you're 5 days to a deadline and it gets and you're about to start working on it and then it gets extended, you're going to wait until you're 5 days from that deadline before you start. And that leads me to the second point, which is procrastination, which goes very much hand in hand in what we've been talking about. But this whole idea of procrastination, and this, I'm a huge victim of this, and we've talked about this before, and we'll probably talk about it again. I've always been of the mindset, well, hey, I just work better under pressure, so, you know, it's really a good thing that I procrastinate. But if you really think about it, no one, and you're probably going to agree with this, no one actually does work better under pressure. If they're actually working and they can be relaxed and take their time and thoroughly think out whatever they're doing, the end product is going to be so much better. But those of us who do procrastinate, we're all about, hey, I just work better under pressure, so procrastination is a skill that I have almost.
So you're saying that people, they don't, when they're under pressure, they don't produce work faster, or they don't produce quality work?
Quality. I think, you know, people don't work better under pressure, but they do work because there is pressure, and there's a huge difference.
So do we live for that type of pressure? Is that something we kind of get a high off of?
I do. I mean, you know, this can be translated to anything. I mean, like you mentioned, in college, getting papers done, a lot of people will wait till the last minute. And in the business world as well, and like we're talking about deadlines, and I just think people procrastinate, and then when they get things done at the last minute, they feel all proud. Yeah, you know, I sucked it up, and I did it, and I did it right, and I did it good. But if you were to somehow force them to have done it over the time, you know, the whole time, the end product would have been better.
We all utilize the Parkinson's law, which is that time kind of expands to how much time you need for a project. To finish it, that's how much time you're going to need for it. Especially like we talked about with college papers, we know, okay, I need to finish this paper by tomorrow. It's 10 pages. I haven't started. You're going to finish that paper by the next day. It's because of the Parkinson's law. And we all subscribe to that in a certain way. I guess the thing is, how do we use Parkinson's law, but use it to produce quality work at the same time? I don't think I've figured that answer out.
Now, the third reason why extending deadlines is probably not a good idea is that this thing that psychologists call the planning fallacy, and it's the tendency to underestimate how long things will actually take. And I mean, I can just 100% with my day job agree to this. Humans are awful about judging how long something's going to take. Like, we underestimate the time in general, just like, you know, hey, this might going to take me 10 days. Well, really, it might actually be taking you 20, but because you're human, we have this planning fallacy, which naturally we underestimate things. And then we plan for best case scenarios. We always say, okay, so step A will lead to step B, will lead to step C, and after it's all done, it's going to take me X amount of days. Good. But we don't plan for any buffer in case things go wrong. And then the third thing behind this is we don't consider the little things, the subcomponents of these projects that we're working on. We just look at this big picture. We look at best case scenario. And then on top of all that, we underestimate. So this planning fallacy is a huge thing, and maybe one of the biggest reasons of all that extending deadlines is a bad thing.
I agree with you. If it's over like a long period of time, we're not going to be as motivated to finish it because the deadline, and this goes back to the pressure of a deadline. Yes, I think things are going to take longer if you don't have the pressure on to you and the deadline's not closing. Yes, I think we are not going to know how long something's going to take. But once it gets to that deadline, I think you're able to look at a project and say, okay, I can allot this hour for this, this hour for that, this hour for that.
Well, we focused a lot on the problems. And before we wrap up, I want to focus on at least a little bit of the solutions. And maybe you and I can each give our best solutions. But my answer to this, and the way I try to not let extending deadlines or just procrastination in general attack me and get the better of me, is I try to set interim deadlines for myself. So if I have this big project that in reality the only thing that matters is the finished product is done by this date, well, I try to find little middle points, you know, two or three times throughout this project that I can set a deadline and say that little part needs to be done by, you know, a certain time, so that I can, you know, have multiple goals to go for. So even if I procrastinate, I'm procrastinating on each of those little goals as opposed to the main, you know, deadline as a whole.
I kind of do that. I actually have two. One of them is kind of like what you said. I don't really set deadlines, but I, instead of looking at the big picture, and I'm a big picture thinker and I'm trying to look more detailed now, but if you start, look at the stuff that it's kind of like paying down debt too. You look at the small stuff first, and this is what I do, and I get rid of all the small stuff first. Like, I do it as quick as I can. I say, okay, this is going to take me 30 minutes. It's going to take me an hour. I get those done. So then I have less on my plate, first of all, and then that's less overwhelming.
And then a second thing that I do is that, and this is something I'm just starting to do and I'm realizing the benefits of it, is you get up earlier than you need to. Instead of, if you work at 8, don't wake up at 7, get in the shower and go right to work. Wake up at 5 or 6, because then you have this extra time on your hand. And then you start to realize there's stuff I can do in this time. So you start to value your time more and you start to enjoy the time that you have more. And so when it comes to starting to do projects and deadlines and whatnot, you learn how to value your time while you're working on those things and know how to, I guess, divide your distraction time and divide when you're working on something.
Well, there's certainly some problems to be aware of and some solutions that you can take action on to prevent the problems in the future. But now let's get on to round two.
Round two.
Right now, what Joe and I want to look at is, I guess you can call it a blog post by someone who almost all our listeners are going to be familiar with, and that's Dan Miller from 48 Days, who's actually going to be coming on to talk about this topic and lots of other things a little later on in the main event. But this is something that kind of caught my attention because it was somewhat uncharacteristic for Dan, who a lot of people know as a somewhat docile and friendly figure in the entrepreneur space. What happened was Dan was listening to an episode of Dave Ramsey, and one of the callers was a gentleman who called Dave and said that his wife had recently graduated with her PhD. She had gotten a great job, and he was excited to be quitting his job and doing nothing, is how Dan retold the story. And I wasn't listening to that episode of Dave Ramsey, so I'm not sure exactly. But that's the synopsis of what Dan gives. And he says that this guy was then given some information by Dave about some things he could do, different investment strategies and such. And Dan was really somewhat appalled that Dave didn't call this guy out for more or less being, I don't know, being not playing his role as the man in this relationship and not taking some kind of responsibility to continue to earn money for the family regardless of what the wife is doing. And Dan got, I don't know, 20 or 30 responses to this blog post, and they were pretty much split down the middle. Half the people were saying, yeah, Dan, right on, you know, you gotta uphold these, I guess, old school values. Whereas the other half, and admittedly, many of them were women, were more or less saying, Dan, we like your other stuff, but you're a freaking sexist in this situation. Like, how can you be so old school and not adapting to how the new world is functioned, where men are equal to women? And this is a really hot button topic, so I'm glad we're bringing Dan on to give his opinionated point of view. But Joe, feel free to let me know what you think about this.
Well, I guess it goes back to girl power, which we've had an episode about that, and I'm sure there's many ladies out there who would love to just, I guess, be like the sugar mama and have the husband take home and be Mr. Dad. And I actually know some people that are like that. And I guess, like you said, it is a hot topic, because if you say, oh, the man's is the one that's supposed to be with the job and taking care of the family and whatnot, then you have that whole, oh, are women not capable of doing that? And then you get into that whole topic. And I think maybe Dan, is he kind of hinting at something like that, that he's the more traditional, the man should take care of the money and the woman should take care of the kids?
Yeah, and I think Dan absolutely is taking that stance that, you know, old school brother. He thinks that the man should be making money for the family regardless of whether or not the woman of the household is also doing it.
Well, which side of the fence do you sit on?
I don't know if you call it new school, just more open to pretty much, I guess you would call it equal rights, but just more equal treatment. You know, if the wife is more educated or does have a better position and there is a need for someone to stay at home, I guess, with the kids or stay at home and take care of the house or do the chores, I don't see any difference between the man doing one thing and the woman doing the other or vice versa. I really think that nowadays, because women are able to get the same jobs and hold the same positions as men, that there really should be no difference in how you view this.
Well, that goes back to then, is it then whoever can make the most money should be the one working, or is it the one who feels the most strongly about the work they're doing and enjoy it that should be doing the working?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a family by family decision. There's arguments that can be made for both, and it really, I don't think in this particular situation, it's any place for Dan to be passing judgment on this gentleman for what they're doing. And he admits that he maybe doesn't know the full story. There might be something else going on. But he does say specifically, like, it's your, and I don't want to get into any kind of religion argument whatsoever, but Dan's point in this is that it's almost it's as God or as the Bible says that the man should be the provider.
Well, I think I'm more on his side. I know you were kind of think that it should be case by case or equal, but I think that men have always been the providers, been the protectors, and the woman has usually been the caregiver. And if there is opportunity, I think, for the woman to have a career and have kids, I think, and they're open to that, that should be good. But I don't think if the man has an opportunity to be the caregiver, he has the skills for it, he should be the one taking that initiative and letting the woman take care of the family.
Yeah, well, this is a super hot button topic, and I'm very excited to get Dan on. So I don't want to waste any more time. Let's get Dan Miller from 48 Days into the ring for the showdown in the main event.
It's time for the main event.
In the main event today, Joe and I are pumped to welcome a man who simply needs no introduction. However, he certainly deserves one. Dan Miller is a New York Times best-selling author and has created his brand around the title of one of his best-known books, 48 Days to the Work You Love. Dan is an in-demand speaker, a highly sought-after coach, and has one of the top podcasts around. One of Dan's biggest passions, however, is his family, which is one of the main things we brought Dan on to talk about today. So I don't want to waste any more time. Let's take it to the one, the only, Dan Miller. Dan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, I'm delighted to be one of your early guests here.
Yeah, and we, you're one of the first people we reached out to, and you're in such demand, as I mentioned earlier, that we had to wait and we had to take our time, but it's definitely going to be worth the wait.
Well, I hope so. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Great. Now in round two, Joe and I discussed a recent blog post you authored that focused on a guy who called into Dave Ramsey's show, and he bragged about the fact that he quit his job because his wife had obtained one, so he didn't have to work anymore. And Joe and I, when we were talking about it, we each had slightly different takes on this situation, but we noticed that not only were you very passionate about it on one side of the issue, but some of your audience was very polarized one way or the other. So could you start off by kind of giving us a little recap of this and what made you feel so passionately about this that you wanted to talk about it, and maybe where you stand on the issue and why?
Boy, you guys want to jump right into a bag of worms, don't you?
Yep, exactly.
Well, the caller, and I just caught it, you know, on the car coming back from lunch, and a guy called in and said he had just quit. He had been at a job for 10 years, and he just quit. First day of freedom. Yay, I'm free. And Dave says, gee, what's up with that? You know, he says, well, his wife just got a PhD, got a really fabulous job, and he didn't have to work anymore. And I thought, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, that raises so many red flags. I mean, number one, meaning obviously he wasn't doing work that was meaningful to him. It was just simply a paycheck. Well, that's a sad situation to be in for anybody. So granted, he ought to quit. But to then add to that, my wife just got a fabulous job, so I don't have to work anymore. I'm like, I can't imagine the mentality of that or what that does to the dynamics of their family relationship. Now, I know, and as you guys know from my response, I mean, I thought it was absolutely ludicrous. You know, and I went on to make some rather snide remarks about the guy, not knowing anything about the situation, obviously. Now, certainly, you know, a lot of times I pick up a hot topic and put it out there just to generate stimulating conversation. I don't know anything about the guy's situation. Maybe he's a multimillionaire and, you know, he can sit around the house. But the implication was that now I'm going to just depend on my wife to provide the income so I can do nothing. I mean, that is something I absolutely cringe. I run into too many situations where I find guys who are doing just that. They've had 14 months in a job search, you know, 2 months out of work. I mean, 2 years out of work, whatever. Because they figured out, the bottom line is they figured out they can just squeak by making a living by just living on what their wife is making. I think that is disastrous to a marriage relationship. I know I'm sexist. I'm old fashioned. Absolutely. But I don't think it works to try to pull that off. I don't see situations where that works well.
So let's talk about someone who is an quote-unquote entrepreneur who might be in this situation, but they don't really realize it. Like, they think, you know, they don't have a job, they don't have the job, so they think they're living the dream. But in reality, they're either not making any money, not making any progress, maybe losing money. What can any of our listeners who might maybe be on the fence in that situation, what can they do to step back and say, hey, that's me. I need to, you know, step up and stop being this guy.
I run into people all the time. I mean, I live in Nashville, Tennessee. We're in a city full of creative people. And I run into guys who are songwriters. Okay, you know, how's that working for you? Well, man, every day I'm out there, you know, connecting with people. I'm writing songs. How much money have you generated in the last 3 years? Zero. You got to be kidding me. You don't have a job. You don't have a career. You may have a hobby, but you don't have anything responsible. I don't care how gifted you are as a songwriter. Get your butt out there. Get a job at Home Depot or Taco Bell where you're generating income. I think it's totally irresponsible to go for an extended period of time as an entrepreneur, as much as I love the idea of entrepreneurship, where you're not generating income. You can't do that. I mean, I've started businesses, entrepreneurial businesses all my life, but I've always had a plan to provide for the basic needs of my family. If that means mowing yards or painting houses or delivering newspapers, I don't care. But I always had a plan for at least providing the basics while I was building a business. I think things start to deteriorate in the emotional dynamics in a family and a marriage relationship when a guy says, hey, I'm living my dream, you know, but I haven't generated any income for 2 years. Nah, not going to fly in my boat.
Well, I'm going to look at the gender role. If, say, this was Switch and it was a woman calling saying the same exact thing, are you still that upset, or is it just because it's a man that said that?
It's really just because it's a man. And there you go. Now you know. It's different. I mean, my wife has never had to generate income. I mean, her biggest concerns are making sure that her pedicure and her hairstyling appointments don't overlap. I mean, that's cool. She does whatever she wants to. So, yeah, it's different. I just, as a guy, I could not live with myself in doing that. I think it is my responsibility to provide for my family, not my wife. So it's very much a sexist thing. Now, if a couple agreed, you know, on a set period of time, hey, for 6 months, you know, you can do this thing. I'm making good income. Gee, the wife is a radiologist or something like that where she's making good income and says you can have this period of time to really test your idea, see if it'll fly. I'm fine with that. But to have just an indefinite period of time where the guy's generating no income because the wife's making enough that they can live on, I think it's disastrous to the way things ought to be.
But Dan, I have to jump in and say I'm concerned. What about your pedicure appointments and your hair appointments?
I work those in around my work where I'm generating income. Thank you very much.
All right.
But say, what if your wife came to you and said, I want to be the one to start working and you stay home. Is that something you'd be fine with?
Well, now you're talking about like if we had kids and I'm going to be Mr. Mom and where she has the ability. I mean, I've seen that where the wife is a cardiologist. And because of her income, I mean, I knew a couple one time where she, in fact, was in the medical profession. Her ability to earn, he was a teacher. She could earn 10 times what he did. They discussed that and just decided that they didn't want to put their kids in daycare. And he stayed home with the kids while the kids were small because her earning potential so far outweighed his. They did that, and I'm not going to throw stones at that. I couldn't do that personally. But if they want to do it and they're agreed on it, happy life. I'm okay with that. But I think it's a rare, rare situation where that's going to work.
Well, it sounds like you're focusing a lot of this on, like your ideas on this, on who's got the higher earning potential. So it's all about the money. Is that what it is?
Well, no, it's not that. It goes deeper than that. I mean, I would have a hard time laying my head on a pillow at night, you know, next to my wife and going to sleep if I hadn't generated any income in 2 years. We didn't have small kids in the house, and she's out there busting her butt every day. I just couldn't do that. I think it's a weird kind of torquing of roles. And again, if that appears sexist, old-fashioned, That's fine with me. It's just that I know I couldn't handle it as a guy. And I've seen the inside of too many of these situations. That's why I have a whole lot of history here. I've got 25 years of being a life coach with people and seeing situations where they tried to pull this off. And I don't see situations where it works well. It's disastrous to the relationship. I've got a guy right now that I'm working with who has not worked for about 16 months. His wife has a great income and he wants to nurture his little dream. And I said, look, the things you're talking about have a really long ramp up time. We're talking about a significant period of time before you can even dream about generating any significant income. Is your wife okay with this? He says, yeah, she's fine. She thinks it's cool. I said, I want you to have that conversation with her. Now, I don't know his wife. I don't know anything about their situation other than him working with me. I said, I want you to have that conversation with her. He said, well, gee, if you insist, everything's cool here. But he said, Friday night, we're going out for dinner. Well, I'll have that conversation. He came back. He says, oh, my gosh. He said, she shared how resentful she is that it's taken so long for me to generate income and that she thinks that I just need to go get a job. I says, oh, isn't that interesting? Here you are trucking along thinking everything's cool and she's about to blow a gasket with resentment. Because you're not doing anything to, you're just kind of, you know, chasing your dream. That's something that may have bring income in a year down the road. Yep, I see that again and again and again. You get down to the core, and I guarantee you there's resentment there if the guy isn't generating income.
So it sounds like kind of the key to these kind of situations is something that's huge in relationships and family, and that's communication. I mean, how big is communication in this whole situation?
Well, it's very big, as it is in any healthy relationship. So it's not unique to just this situation. No matter what the dynamics of or who's generating income, communication is key. And a lot of people, you know, don't work at that as much as they. I'm a big, big proponent of healthy marriages. Man, I've been blessed beyond belief. My wife is my greatest sounding board, my lover, my best friend. She is so many things to me. So I'm a big believer in having a healthy relationship. But you know what? I am just as strategic about being successful in my marriage as I have ever been in building a business. And that's where I see this get a lot different. People think, well, gee, I'm married. You know, I made the commitment. I told her I loved her. You know, if anything changes, I'll let you know. And they're trucking along, you know, trying to build their dream. No, I am very strategic about the way that I make deposits in the marriage that I want to continue. I mean, my wife and I have Friday nights are date night. We've been married 45 years. Friday, my wife is like a 16-year-old. The excitement of knowing Friday night is our date night. She knows I'm going to plan something. I'm not going to let anything else interfere with that. I'm not going to say yes. Somebody else is coming to town. They want to meet. No, that's date night. And so that's the way we treat it. And the what that has done to build the continuing foundation, stability, and thrill of our marriage is just beyond description.
I like that. I like that a lot. So let's maybe take all these things we've talked about so far and turn it all upside down. Whereas the initial situation we talked about is what if this guy is 100% relying on the wife's income and he's doing his own little dream on the side. Well, let's say he is working full time, but he still has this dream that he wants to work on the side. So instead of doing it in place of his job, he's doing it in addition to his job. And because of that, he's being, instead of 100% only working with the family, he's 100% removed from the family just about. Do you see that situation a lot too?
Yes, I do. And I think that's a reasonable transition if it has a timeline connected to it. Now, if he's doing something on the side, it requires another 20 hours a week. So he's working 40 hours and then, you know, another 20 hours doing that. Yeah, he's going to be drawing from the success of another area in his life. And usually that is in the relationship area. So wife and kids or whoever, you know, whichever way it's going. You can't do that forever. And that's where I challenge guys who are doing this. We'll stick to the guys for a minute since that's your example. There ought to be a timeline connected with that. If you start a sideline business and you really believe that it can replace your income and go on from there to dramatically increase your income, rock and roll. But I think that ought to happen in a 90 to 180 day time frame. That's 3 to 6 months. If it goes beyond 6 months and you're generating $400, then I don't think it's a serious business. If it does, if it's not showing the exponential growth to come up and replace your income in that period of time, man, deep six it. Go on to something else. Just be realistic. It's a sideline hobby. Don't continue dedicating that kind of time to it. If it's something you want to nurture, you're, you know, selling things on eBay, so you list them. Well, spend 4 or 5 hours a week doing that, and you can continue doing that. But don't immerse so much time in it that it is drawing from success in other areas of your life.
Are you saying if after 3 to 6 months, if that's not working, neglect that and then start something else that'll be 20-hour plus, or just find something that just won't take even near that long and just go at that?
Well, I don't think you can have just a continuing series of 6 month time frames where you're trying to figure out something that'll work. I think there ought to be a learning curve where you learn from the first one and the next one isn't going to take as much time. So I don't think this ought to be an ongoing process of always having something that's sucking 20, 30, 40 hours in addition to your regular work life. But, you know, I mean, look at the kind of things that we have available today. We're not talking about, you know, starting a landscaping business that really is time intensive. If you're doing that, golly, I mean, get your customers lined up before you ever make the switch at all. And when you make the switch, make it fully so you can engage in that, because it's so time and labor intensive. And just do that, confident that you're going to build that into the success that you want. But so many people that I see are doing something where it is a little online business, or they get involved in, you know, blogging or podcasting or doing something online. And those things have tremendous potential. But I don't think you can justify that enormous intake of time there unless it's generating income in a fairly short period of time.
Okay, so let's keep it on the family talk, but stray away a little bit from the husband and wife, and let's talk about the kids a little bit. What, I guess, when you were doing your own thing before children and after, what adaptions did you make? And I know Pat Flynn recently talked about he feels his business actually improved once he had children because he was forced to learn to delegate and not do everything himself, and things have started to take off. Did you have any experiences like that?
Yeah, and Pat does a great job of that. And I know Pat's family and his dedication to that. I think the kind of businesses that a lot of us have today where it's not time and labor intensive. It's not a matter of working 80 hours and you double your success. If you delegate, if you have good systems in place, you can go from working a 40-hour full-time job to working 25 hours and double your income. And I love that kind of potential. So I think we have to, you know, I don't want to just use the old worn out adage, you know, don't work harder, work smarter, but there's a lot of truth in that. So we ought to be not doing everything ourselves if it requires 80 hours a week, but find strategic partners whose skills complement our own and offload some of the things. So we stay focused on the two or three things that we do really well. Now that's what I've done. I mean, in a small business like I have, there are probably 20, 25 things that need to be done. Well, guess what? I probably do two or three of those pretty well. That's where I spend my time. I don't do all those other things that anybody else can step in and do. I try to just identify what is it that only I can do, so I spend my time doing that. Now, in terms of having kids, and my kids are grown. I mean, my kids are grown, but like today's an example. My granddaughter is at our house. She spent the night here. She went to art class with my wife, her Yaya, right here at the sanctuary, the building that I work out of. There's an art class here on Wednesday. So Clara was in there. Well, at about 11:30, I had recorded my podcast. I was ready to go grab some lunch. And so I went in and asked Clara, I said, hey, you want to go with me or you want to go with your grandma and the gals that she's going to go to lunch? Well, she wanted to go with me because she knows that we go to some really cool places. So I took my granddaughter at 11:30. We went to a local Mexican restaurant, Garcia's. We sat outside. We were the only ones outside. Now, we were under a roof, but it rained like crazy. I mean, thunder and lightning and just blistering rain while we were there. We had a blast. We sat there for 2 hours and just ate chips, talked, took pictures, put them up on Instagram, communicated with other family members. We just hung out and had a good time. Then we came back to my office. My bookkeeper was here working on stuff, but Claire and I continued just to doodle around. She created three little books while she was here in that period of time. And at about 3 o'clock, her Yaya, my wife, came back from the lunch she had been at with her friends. By then, Claire had created three little books. She had them laid out on the counter here with a little sign underneath with a dollar, $1 sign on it. So she had three books ready to sell to any customers that happened to come by. Well, obviously, she found her three customers really quickly, one of those being me. I mean, so I had a big chunk of my day today that was devoted to my granddaughter. Nobody knows that. I didn't get behind. It just is the kind of margin that I have and the kind of work that I do where I can do that. Now, granted, I love what I do. I put in a lot of time. I've got manuscript deadlines looking over my shoulder right now. But that's okay. I've got that kind of fluidity in the work that I do, where if something comes up that I consider more important, like granddaughter being here, man, that's where I am.
Well, so it sounds like they start young in your family going down the path to follow grandpa. So that's great.
Last Saturday, she had a booth at the local farmer's market with her muffins. And she had a sign out there. She had music. She would call you in. She was dressed like the Victorian era. If you bought a muffin, she would then ask you if you wanted her special sauce on top of that. She's raising money to buy a camera that she wants. And her parents, rather than just getting her the camera, are teaching her how to get those things you want. It's by starting a little business. Yes, absolutely. They start young around here.
So then I want to take this to a place where a lot of our listeners, and I'm sure, and I know a lot of your listeners, they are not entrepreneurs right now, but they desperately want to be. But of course, a lot of your listeners are older adult age, and they are kind of behind the curve already. Not that they can't do it, but they didn't get started young. But they desperately want to, I guess, impart this wisdom that they know now onto their children, their grandkids, so that they might have this opportunity way sooner than them. What kind of advice can you give to them so, you know, even though they can't necessarily lead by example, for them to teach these lessons to the young ones?
Well, there's so many places where we can learn. There's so many people that are willing mentors. Once you define the area where you want to become an expert, it's so easy to access wisdom to get yourself there quickly today. I mean, look at the things we have, the TED Talks that we've got online are invaluable at learning new areas quickly. Things like Udemy and Lynda that have just massive content out there. Con, you can become an expert in pretty much anything that you want to. So if you want to learn entrepreneurial skills, you don't have to live through it for 20 years to be able to teach your kids how to start a business. Just give them access to the best resources out there. Show them how to have a muffin stand at the local farmer's market. Golly, they can learn while doing it, and we can help. But the real key is, you know, we don't superimpose the path that our kids are going to run on. We have to learn how they are wired. I mean, I'm going to have grandkids that are best suited to have a traditional job sitting in a cubicle somewhere. I know that. I don't want to do them wrong by forcing them to take a path like I've taken. The path I've taken fits me because I know Dan Meller so well. But as I learn to know my grandkids well, I'll learn how to help them be excellent in doing what they are gifted in doing.
Well, for most of the people that you've coached, or, I mean, you've met tons and tons of people, do you see a lot of people with that type of mindset, or do you see most people are the opposite?
Well, I'll have to admit, I've made a very good living helping people who at 45 realize that they're living somebody else's dream. So I've worked with physicians, attorneys, dentists, pastors, accountants who realize it's not their dream they're living their parents' dream. So there are a whole lot of people who were put on a path because of other people's expectations. That's still very, very common. I mean, we've had this generational kind of thing in our culture where every generation is expected to move up academically and socioeconomically. Well, how do you do that when baby boomers knocked it out of the park with a dot-com business, or we have a brain surgeon? What if his son is gifted as a carpenter, or worse yet, a musician? My gosh, are we going to help him be excellent in doing that? Are we going to say, hey, no, geez, I went to Harvard Medical School. By God, you're going to go to Harvard Medical School as well. That's what happens a lot. And so I get the aftermath of that, where these guys are now 45, 50 years old saying, geez, I'm making good money and I hate my life. What's up with that? So we can at any point help people come back to find that true, authentic self. When we talk to people who we know are approaching death, and they know it as well, the number one regret that we hear time and time again, nothing is a close second, is, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life authentic to myself rather than living out the expectations of others. That's the resentment of all these baby boomers who are going into nursing homes because they don't know what to do with their life, and they're just going to go now sit in a rocking chair until death shows up. They never figured out how to put legs on their authentic self. That's what I want to do, whether somebody is 6 years old, like my granddaughter, or they're 66.
How do you take an attorney who's making six-figure plus multiple times, how do you take them and say, okay, maybe the thing that you really want to do is this, and it makes way less money? How do you get them to transition from that huge money lifestyle to something smaller?
The first thing we have to do is not make an assumption that we're going to go down on income. And that's exactly what you verbalized, is exactly what people think. Geez, I'm a dentist. I'm making $350 a year. If I do anything else, my income is going to plummet. I'm going to, you know, make $60,000. Why would you think that? Why would you think that you're going to go down? Why can't we entertain the ideas where you'd make $500,000 a year? I mean, the options for that are certainly not limited. So that's my mindset. That's what I go in with. Identify where you want to be income-wise. Now we're going to screen ideas that only have the potential to put you into that category. And I've helped lots of doctors walk out of having to be in the medical community and are doing some really cool things these days. You know, I've helped pastors. I mean, I'm looking at a beautiful, beautiful piece of art in my office here done by a pastor who was very respected, honored in what he did, and obviously living somebody else's dream. It was a horrible fit. Well, today he's an artist, but his art pieces sell for $10,000-$12,000. He's making four times the money he ever dreamed of making as a pastor. There's really no reason to assume we're going to move down. Now, has that happened? Absolutely. I've got a dentist who, in fact, was making about $350. He went back to school, sold his practice, went back to school, got a master's degree in family and life counseling. Absolutely loves what he's doing. And he's making about $60,000. He says, I've never loved my life more. Mm-hmm. Now, we were able to do some pretty unique things because he had a very successful practice that we were able to sell. And the sale of that practice, it put him into a position financially that gave him a real head start. I'll have to admit that. But he has adjusted the income in cash flow dramatically and loves it, has never regretted for a second having made that change. So can it happen? Yeah, it can. I mean, there are a lot of people who are making big bucks who are not attached to the big bucks at all. And they can have everything they want in life if they're making $60,000. So, but again, this is a very personalized, individualized process. We start by establishing, where do you want to be 3 years from now in seven different areas of your life? Once we identify that, then we have a clear filter by which to gauge any ideas that we look at. But we don't need to assume that just because somebody's making $500,000 a year now in their profession, that we can't duplicate that even if we erase the initials behind their name.
So for someone who is, their expertise is in dentistry, do you, or anything in the medical or anything like that, do you see most of their, if they don't want to go down to 60,000, they want to stay at 350, like you mentioned, do they have to then go and do something in that same field to keep up with that income level, or do you already find something in a totally different industry or area that they can suddenly start making that much money again?
It covers both spectrums. I mean, there's an attorney friend of mine here in Nashville who is no longer practicing law. He was very successful. He now has two sushi bars and is looking for locations. I'm trying to help him find a place here in Franklin, but he's looking for a couple new locations. I mean, he's rocking and rolling with what he's doing. So it doesn't have to be that they walk away from that. But at the same time, I worked with a dentist a couple years ago, and three different times he had tried to leave dentistry with ill-conceived plans. And the last time ended up filing bankruptcy. And he crawled back into dentistry because that's where he could make $300,000 or $400,000 a year. He was doing it and dreading every day. As we unpacked what drew him to dentistry, it wasn't the clinical practice of dentistry. It was the fact that he could be in business for himself, wear nice clothes, have extraordinary income, be respected in the community. I says, wow, we got a whole lot of things that'll fill that bill. What we did was create a buying co-op for dentists. He knows the needs of dentists. There's like 112,000 independent dentists in the United States. When they wear out a rotary piece, that little thing, that zin, 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 they just go looking for another one. He went to the vendors and said, look, if I bring you a buying block, so people are going to buy from you and not just go shop the market out there. They're going to buy from you. Will you give us discounts? Well, sure they will. Deep discounts. Then he went back to dentists. And our goal was in 90 days to get, let's see, to get a 1,000 dentists out of those 112,000, get 1,000 dentists who would pay $28 a month to be part of that buying co-op. He did that and more. Gee, that's a kind of a nice start. In 90 days, we had $28,000 a month in income coming in as a basis, a business that cost no money to start, but it still validated his previous training. I couldn't have done it. I don't have the background in dentistry that he does, but it put him into a business where he would be in business, but never again have to put his hands in somebody's slimy mouth. That's the kind of transition that I look for, where we validate the person's academic and work history, but get them out of the thing that's given them so much pain.
So Joe kind of led into this idea generation type topic and where to come up with what you're going to do. And your approach to this, I love, and it's different than other people's because you seem to combine this looking for something that you're passionate about along with something that's, you know, reasonably expected to make some kind of money. Whereas a lot of people just preach either go towards your passion or go towards the money. Have you always had this philosophy or did it come out of some experience that you had?
I've always had this philosophy. I've always looked for and solutions, not either or. This garbage about, gee, you can, you know, do what you're passionate about and starve to death or just be responsible and get out here and work in something that needs to be done. I mean, that's a bunch of crap. Why would you settle for that? Why is it unreasonable to expect both? I mean, I had a school teacher call recently when I was doing a radio interview. And she said, gee, she used to work in a faith-based school and loved what she was doing, loved the support of the parents and everything, but she was making peanuts. Well, she left to add more family income, took another position in a school. Now she doesn't have that kind of parental support. There's dissension in the classroom, but she's making, you know, twice the money. Should she go back to what she was doing previously or just stay where she was? And I'm like, okay, we have choices A and B. How about choices C through Z? Why would it be unreasonable to expect that you can go out here, find something that increases your income even more and still has the environment that you're looking for? People so quickly narrow down and just assume, you know, these are all my choices. A lot of what I do is simply help people expand their list of options. I mean, Thomas Edison used to say, you know, people, you talk about finding a needle in the haystack, and what do they do when they find the needle? They stop looking. He says, I just keep looking. There may be 10 more needles in that haystack. Mm-hmm. That's the approach that I take with people when we're looking for ideas. Yes, here is A and B. It seems like we've got two clear choices. All right, let's put them on a shelf. Let's find six other choices that would give you the very best of what you want. I have a poster that I got when I was probably 26 years old. And it's got a picture of this real classic car in front of a big mansion and all the other kind of attachments around. And at the bottom, there's a little quotation that says, my tastes are simple. I like to have the best. I joked about that at the time when I was just a young kid. But as I've gone through life, I've discovered, why would you settle for less? Now, this is not all about making money. Again, there are a lot of people who are very content. I'm not going to change their perspective. It's not everybody has to have a big house and a Mercedes in the driveway. But if that's part of what you want, then let's look at options that embrace that as well.
I'm going to look at the, I guess I want to dig further. You mentioned the attorney and then he went to like sushi restaurants. How does that, I guess I just want to dig in. How does that connection form? Like, are you giving him like a test? Are you asking him like, what do you like to do? What do you like to eat? Is that how that process works?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, when we go through the initial stages of coaching, it's just unpacking everything. What are you drawn to? What do you spend your time when you're not working? What do you spend your time doing? What is it that when you're doing it, time just flies by? When is it that you feel like you're in the zone? We talk about athletes being in the zone. When is it you're in the zone? And I mean, a lot of times we come up with things that are just seemingly way out in left field. That's where we start building. I had a client I worked with just yesterday who's been very successful, been in the same corporation for 28 years, highly compensated individual, very analytical. You know what he really wants to do? Something with art. But he makes $250,000 a year, and that's one of his concerns. I'm saying, okay, we're going to look at how you can take your primary interest, that being in art, and I'm going to show you 10 different ways you can expect to make $500,000. He's like, are you kidding me? I said, sure. Here's the deal, guys. I work with a lot of authors. You know, I love being an author. It has served me extremely well. We know that 95% of authors never make more than $40,000 a year. Wow, is that a turnoff to me as an author? Mm-hmm. No. My response is, golly, how difficult can it be to put yourself in that 5%? All I have to do is look around at other authors and do things they aren't doing. It's not complicated. And that's exactly what I do with people like that. So you want to be an artist? We know what they say about artists. Everybody knows. Starving artist. Sure. The starving artist. Man, you know how easy it is to just do creative things that bring in extraordinary kind of income? Cal, I mean, I wish you could peek in the group that was here in the sanctuary earlier today. These artists, these gals are doing some amazing things. I mean, one of the gals decided at Christmas time to do the 12 days of Christmas. She did 8 by 8, 8 inches by 8 inches, little canvases, and just let it be known she was going to do these 12 of them, $300 each. Well, because there was that sense of urgency, limited supply, people were saying, hey, I want day 8 before she even did it. And she's like, what are you, crazy? You don't even know what I'm going to do. Well, I don't know. I don't care. I want that one. What was so wildly successful, she extended it another 12 days. So she did the first 24 days in December. Each one did a little 8 by 8. Didn't take her much time. $300 a piece. She is still trying to catch up with ones that people want done that they saw in that period of time, and they want one like that. It just carried over. But there's that sense of urgency. 12 Days of Christmas was kind of a cool concept. Boom, she knocked it out of the park.
Well, I like the idea of doing these things that, you know, is within your passion, but also using a little intelligence to see what other people aren't doing to kind of capitalize on that. And as we're wrapping up here, I wanted to get your thoughts on that's something you're doing and with your live events and your coaching. And you even mentioned just a group that was there recently today. You kind of cater each of your sessions to specific groups. So while some people do entrepreneurship conferences or entrepreneurship meetups kind of thing, it seems like you like to partition people off. So you're going to have a group that comes in that all are coaches, or a group that comes in and they're all artists or all writers. What led you to doing that type of event as opposed to the more generic type?
Well, the two that you mentioned, and we've done events for just coaches, lots of them, and events for just writers. Those simply grew out of people asking me, Dan, how can I do what you've done with your books? And rather than explaining that 20 times a month to people, I finally decided, why don't we just do an event and invite other authors to come and I'll show them exactly what I've done to have the success that I've had with 48 Days to the Work You Love and other books. Same thing is true with coaching. Gee, Dan, how can I do what you've done with coaching? And I finally decided, with so many request for that information, let's do an event. Now, we're doing an event here in a couple weeks that I'm just totally stoked about, and it's called Innovate. Now, it grew out of one of the events that we were doing, that being Right to the Bank, WRIT, where we were working with writers, and we realized we were drawing people into that event who were not writers. They were musicians, they were speakers, coaches, other people who had creative skills, but they were asking the same questions. And what I focus on primarily in that event is not the craft of writing, but the business of writing. How can you take your writing and generate extraordinary income? So we had other people showing up, sneaking in, who weren't writers, but wanted the same information. So I said, hey, that's cool. Let's do an event for creative people. So I said, let's do an event and we'll call it Innovate. We did a cool kind of thing at the end of Innovate where we integrate the 48 in there as part of the word. So it's a really cool kind of logo that we've got for that. The first one sold out. It was outrageous, the responses we got from people doing that. We're doing another one. It's been sold out for weeks. I mean, sold out weeks in advance, totally maxed out. Nobody can get in. We've got three scheduled for next year, and people are already filling those slots quickly. But here's what we're doing. Like in this event that we've got coming up, now I've got some really cool speakers like Michael Hyatt and other people coming, obviously, that, you know, we've got some real talent coming to share with these people. Chad Jeffers, who's guitarist with Carrie Underwood, and some real creatives who have put legs in what they're doing. I've got Scott Stearman, who's an internationally known sculptor, who's going to come. He's coming in from Colorado. At the beginning of the 2 days, on Thursday morning, it's a Thursday-Friday event, on Thursday morning, he's going to be looking at a 3-foot square block of clay. In the 2 days, while he's sitting in the event, hearing people, getting energized by the things that are going on, in the 2 days, he's going to release, he assures me, a totally original 48 days eagle. It's going to be an eagle on a branch leaning forward where the tips of the wings are like 15 inches extended out in front of the eagle's chest, right at that point where somebody's ready to leave the branch. All the energy is focused into sweeping those wings back. The commitment is there. There's no turning back. We're going to call it the launch. I am so jazzed about that, I can't sleep at night. Now, here's the deal. That's not just another seminar event that we're going to schedule in for all those events next year. That'll never be done again. It's a one-time experience. But that's how I view this whole thing. We don't have to have cookie-cutter solutions. So I bring things to the table to expose people just to help them see things that are right around them that they're missing otherwise. We walk around our property here. You know, I'll send them down the zip line. You know, we'll pick mulberries off the tree if they're in season. We just have people have an experience that goes beyond just new intellectual content. And so many people are sitting right on top of creative skills that are waiting to be released in creative ways if they just put wings on those. And so I'm always, I don't know what events we're going to have next year that we may add on to what we've already got scheduled. But there are so many opportunities out there. And when I have enough people, you know, asking me the same question, I mean, the old theory is we have three people ask you the same question, you know, create a seminar to teach it. And we have people asking questions about this. It makes it so easy to see new opportunities to create events, teaching modules, whether they be, you know, in a podcast, an audio program, or a live seminar, or a tutorial that we have on Udemy. I mean, there's so many ways to put legs on that, and I just keep trying to expose people to that more and more.
Well, those are definitely sound like exciting and unique events, and I know that's why you're booked so far in advance. Now, before we wrap up, why don't you let everyone know where the best place to go to find out more information about those upcoming events that aren't booked up yet and all the other projects you're working on right now?
Well, sure. Thanks. I appreciate that. 48days.com is our primary site. It has tons of information there. But if you look at the live events, it'll show you a drop down of all the events that are scheduled here at the sanctuary. This converted barn on the back of our property just outside of Franklin, Tennessee. It's an amazing place. People love to come here. It's an escape from asphalt and concrete. One of our recent events, we had an attorney from the Bronx here, and he showed us a picture out his office window. It looks right down on Times Square. He's 19 stories up. So being here was a real change of scenery for him, and we introduced him to some fun things here on our property. But 48days.com has all the event information there. And then 48days.net is an interesting place. It's our social networking site. This is for people who are committed to the kind of things that we've been talking about here. Not people who are just content with the status quo, but people are saying, I've got an idea. I want to link arms with some other people on the same path. So we've got about 14,000 people in there right now. We turn away about 18 to 20% of the people who apply there just because we really want it to be people who are on the same path, people who think alike. But that's a place, there's no membership fee or anything, and it's not that difficult to get in. We just want to know that you are thinking like the people there, but that's 48days.net. So between those two, you can get a whole lot of resources to help accelerate your own path to extraordinary success.
Yeah, and we'll definitely link up to those. And 48days.net, it is something that a lot of people are looking for, that type of community and that type of environment. And you can't just go, not all the people, I guess, that are doing what you do have this type of environment for people to, I guess, network with each other with online. So it really is a good place to go, and we'll link up to that. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you coming on.
Well, you're certainly welcome. You guys ask stimulating questions. I'm sure you're going to rock the world with what you're doing.
Thanks, Dan. Dano. Yeah, we'll talk to you later, man. Thanks.
All right. See ya.
Well, that wraps up another episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown. Thank you so much for joining us this week. Now, to find out more about this show and to see the show notes, check out entrepreneurshowdown.com. Leave us some feedback in the comment section and let us know what you think. And if you like what you've heard, do us a huge favor and head to the iTunes store and leave us a 5-star review. So with that, for my partner Joe Cassandra, I'm Dan Franks. We'll see you next week.